BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Dorothy Byrne, the head of news and current affairs at Channel 4 for almost 20 years. She is the trailblazing, award-winning grand dame of television journalism. She's spent a lifetime breaking stories, many of which would otherwise have gone untold. Her recent commissions include the Channel 4 News investigation into the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the Michael Jackson exposé Leaving Neverland, and For Sama, the BAFTA-winning documentary about one family's life under siege in Aleppo, which has also won an Oscar nomination. Last year, she made headlines herself at the Edinburgh Television Festival when she used her platform as keynote speaker to issue a clarion call in support of broadcast journalism as a pillar of our democracy. She demanded that politicians should submit themselves to scrutiny and that journalists and broadcasters should stand up and speak out when political leaders lie. At a time of mistrust and disinformation, she is a firm believer in the importance and power of mainstream news. She says, "We hold power to account, and at our best, we investigate wickedness so it can no longer damage society and individuals. We should be really proud of what we do." Dorothy Byrne, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you for this extraordinary honour.
The newsroom has changed enormously over your tenure since you joined the profession. I mean, obviously, we now have 24-hour news, rolling news of a type on social media. Are we better informed as a result of these changes, do you think?
I think there's a role for all sorts of news. Journalists have a tendency to share the same agenda, and that agenda can be really very narrow. We have a strand, for example, Unreported World, which literally does what it says on the tin. It covers stories that other journalists are not covering. I think all journalists, when they're all talking about Brexit, that concerned me because there were so many other things happening in the world that I felt were not being covered. And we need to do a better job. Brexit has shown us that the different parts of society and of our country don't understand each other well enough. And that's a task where we as journalists have to improve.
We've got so much to talk about today, Dorothy, and we're going to do more of that. But of course, we have your discs to hear too. So I think we should start with your first. What's it going to be and why have you chosen it?
My first is John Grant. I'm the greatest mother something in the world. I don't normally swear, but in this song, there is a point to swearing. We won't hear the swearing version. I love this because it's beautiful and absolutely hilarious. You can't listen to this without bursting out laughing. I also think that when John Grant describes himself, it reminds me a little bit of me. And sometimes when I listen to John Grant songs, I think, I wonder if John Grant is my long-lost identical twin because we have certain similarities about our bad points. But maybe also he says in the song he has a good point too.
You could probably say I'm difficult. I probably talk too much. I overanalyze and overthink things. Yes, it's a nasty crutch. I'm usually only waiting for you to stop talking so that I can.
John Grant and Greatest Living Creature. Dorothy Byrne, you've subtitled your recent book, Trust Me, I'm Not a Politician, as a simple guide to saving democracy. Do you really think that democracy's in peril?
I do, yes. It doesn't seem to people as if it's in peril because we've just had a general election and we've got a clear winner and we should congratulate them because it was a fairly fought election. But I am concerned by the public's low opinion of politicians. In fact, journalists don't share the public's low opinion of politicians because we meet them and we know that, in fact, they entered politics because they thought that they had something to give to society. But when politicians don't come onto television, the most trusted medium, and explain their policies and hold themselves accountable and allow themselves to be challenged, I think that that is bad for democracy because the people who elected them want to hear them justify their policies and want to hear them stand up to scrutiny.
As I said, your McTaggart lecture at last year's Edinburgh TV Festival made headlines, particularly when you called Boris Johnson a liar. Were you surprised by the reaction?
My job is to speak truth to power. And my concern about politicians not telling the truth is not some eccentric view of my own. It's one shared by the British people. It was really depressing when we surveyed 2,000 voters in the election campaign, and only 10% said that they believed that candidates were generally telling the truth. And I think politicians have to listen, not just to me, but to the voters who are saying, we don't trust you. Because if the people stop trusting the politicians, they will lose their trust and faith in democracy. We've seen that happening in America. So if we want to preserve democracy, we have got to get people to trust the politicians again.
It's time to take a break for some music, Dorothy. What have you chosen as your second disc?
Sometimes when you feel really wild and the world is jangling, you might imagine that the sort of music that you should listen to would be calm, peaceful music, Bach or something. But I find when the world is wild and you feel that you're jangling, you should listen to wild and jangling music. And the best one that I recommend is Pere Ubu Non-Alignment Pack.
Pere Ubu and Non-Alignment Pact. Dorothy Byrne, let's go back a bit. You're Scottish, but you were only there for the first 8 years of your life. What are your memories of being brought up there in Paisley and I think Edinburgh for a little while?
Well, the happiest time of my childhood was actually living with my grandmother in Edinburgh. We didn't go to school. Our great aunts lived next door. They were retired teachers and we got up at school time and we went next door. I think they taught my older sisters more. I remember just sitting in the corner reading this children's encyclopedia, just starting A, B, C.
Why weren't you going to school?
My mother wasn't very well, so we went to live with my grandmother for a bit. I think they thought it would be more stable for us.
Tell me then about your parents. They met in the civil service and they were both Catholic. Was it quite a religious household?
Yes, it was religious and I was very religious when I was a small child, yes. When I was nearly nine, we moved to England and our whole family life was quite unhappy at the time. And I became more and more unhappy and for some reason I became obsessed that I'd committed lots of sins and that I was a really bad person and that I had to die. And the only way I could think of dying, because there was no internet then, thank God, was to starve myself to death. But nobody noticed. And also, I kept getting hungry. So I did get thin, but I didn't starve to death. But I was so unhappy.
That childhood memory is incredibly vivid for you then. What's the legacy of that?
I am now a happy person because I realised that I had borrowed the unhappiness of the people around me. But sometimes when I'm watching television and I see a little girl talking about maybe having anorexia or bulimia or feeling really unhappy, in that moment, the terrible feeling that I used to have, the pain of it was like this terrible pressure inside me. As she talks about it, I suddenly feel it again. It makes me want to reach into the television and say to that girl, it can get better. You think you can't become happy again, but you can be happy. It's possible to be happy.
It's time for some more music. Your third disc then.
Well, one of the first pieces of music I ever had when we got a small record player as a child was Handel's Messiah. And although I don't know that my Redeemer liveth, I love the music I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, because I think it's about the spirit of hope that is within human beings.
I Know That My Redeemer Liveth from Handel's Messiah, performed by Dame Joan Sutherland with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. Dorothy Byrne, you attended a Catholic school as a teenager after your family moved to Poulton-le-Fylde, just outside Blackpool. One of your claims to fame is that you won the English-speaking Union National Schools Debating Competition, which must have been quite a big deal.
The nuns, they didn't think they had themselves the wherewithal to teach me. So a man was brought from the Christian Brothers school up the road. And I went into a room alone with him. That would never happen now. And he told me to stand on the table. So I stood on this big Victorian table and he gave me a subject to start speaking about. And as soon as I started speaking about it, he started shouting and swearing at me, saying words I couldn't possibly say here. And I at once stopped and he said, you don't stop, you don't stop. It doesn't matter what anybody says to you, you have to keep going. And it obviously worked because I won the competition. And at work over the years, sometimes horrible men have sworn at me and called me dreadful sexist names, and I've said to them, I'm sorry, it has no effect. I'm trained. It doesn't matter what you say, I will just carry on talking. However, that has its downsides as well. Sometimes I should stop talking.
It's time for your next track. What are we going to hear?
Well, I, after university, was a teacher in Nigeria. And I think there is nothing more spectacular in the world than dancing in Africa. When I first arrived, I danced incredibly quickly, and I was also very bad at dancing. So the girl next door took me and said, you're a really bad dancer, and taught me to dance. So the music that I've chosen is Fela Kuti, Teacher, Don't Teach Me Nonsense. It's actually about colonialism and corruption in Africa, but really it's just great music to dance to.
Fela Kuti and Teacher, Don't Teach Me Nonsense. So, Dorothy Byrne, after university, you went to Nigeria with VSO as a teacher, but you had to come home after just 18 months due to a broken leg. What happened?
I fell off my motorbike and was flown home, and I was put in full-length plaster for a year. So I ended up in the ward for old ladies that I used to visit.
As a volunteer?
As a volunteer. And at night, I can't describe it, they would cry and howl, and they would beg the nurses to bring them bedpans. But the nurses were really cruel to them and didn't come and shouted at them. A lot of them had broken their hips. I have since discovered that hip replacements were available in that period, but they didn't get them. They just lay there, and as far as I could make out, they didn't receive any physiotherapy or other occupational therapy. They just lay there, and eventually they died. After the operation, a doctor came to me and said, you will almost certainly never walk normally again. You will definitely never work again, but we won't know for a year because you'll be in full-length plaster for a year. If I think about that now, that was a terrible thing to say. I mean, people with no legs work. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just ridiculous. But it was a hard time. When I came out of plaster, I couldn't walk very well, but gradually I started to walk a bit better. It was very depressing because all my friends were starting their great jobs and I was on invalidity benefit. I feel great sympathy for other people where things go wrong in their life. They get some form of disability and they can't find ways to get back into work. I think it's so easy to blame people who aren't working and who are living on benefits and disability benefits. But having lived like that, I know how difficult it is. And this idea that everybody wants to employ you if you suddenly say as a disabled person, yes, now I've decided I'm well enough to work and they'll want to employ you. It isn't like that. I moved to London. I thought I have to get away from Blackpool and lived in a bedsit. I'd been told I could, by one person, I could live on invalidity benefit for the rest of my life. So one day I went to get my invalidity benefit and I said to the man, have you got any jobs here? And he said, you don't need a job, you're on invalidity benefit. And I said, no, but I can't stand it. I want a job. So the first job I got after breaking my leg was working on the new benefit for people who had one child.
Let's take another track, Dorothy, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. What are we going to hear before we do that?
I think self-pity is a really important part of surviving as a human being. And this is Dido's Lament by Purcell. Now, if Dido had been my friend, when Aeneas left her, I'd have said, look, you're really good looking, put a bit of makeup on, put the crown on, that'll be very appealing to men, get yourself on a website, put yourself on Tinder, stop the whining. But I have to say, there is no better self-pity pitying piece of music that I've ever heard than this.
Dido's Lament from Dido and Aeneas by Purcell, sung by Jesse Norman with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Raymond Leppard. So you talked about getting yourself a job at a benefit office in Hounslow and also by night to make extra money. I read that you were ripping up dead people. What does that mean?
Well, there was overtime available that you could work at night tearing up the files of benefit claimants who died. There weren't shredders then, but I was desperate for money. And it was in this tower in Hounslow, so I would sit looking out over the darkness of Hounslow, tearing up all these files of people who had died. And you couldn't help reading bits of them, or some of the letters would drop out. And the people would say things like, "My mother has temporarily gone into hospital." And you'd think, "It's not temporary, mate. She's doomed." Because when you looked at the letters, you knew that there was nobody there who hadn't died. It was depressing beyond belief. It was grim and definitely one of the lowest points of my life.
Yeah, what kind of headspace were you in?
I was really worried that my life would never start up again. I started applying to journalism traineeships and I kept getting letters back saying, "You're 24, so you count as an adult entrant, but you're not trained and therefore we have to pay you more and we're not prepared to do that." Anyway, I thought, what should I do? And at that time, Reader's Digest used to send out unsolicited mail saying, "Dear lucky reader, you have won, you have won, you have won. This is what you will actually receive." And I wrote to 50 newspaper editors saying, "Dear lucky editor, you have won, you have won, you have won. You have won the trainee journalist of a lifetime. This is what you will actually receive." And then I described myself. And 49 editors ignored that. But Rex Pardo of the Waltham Forest Guardian contacted me and said, "That was really funny." And he gave me a job.
It's time to go to the music. You're sixth today, Dorothy. What are we going to hear and why?
From local papers, I managed to get into television. And I managed to get a job on World in Action, which was nearly as good as being on Desert Island Discs. It was, I couldn't believe that I was working on this programme that I had admired all my life, full of brilliant men. At the time I joined it, I happened to be the only woman, which was slightly strange, but it was thrilling. Even before working on it, when I heard the music of World in Action, I felt that I was tingling all over. And this is a version, in fact, played by the brilliant Matt Berry.
The theme from World in Action, performed by Matt Berry. So, Dorothy Byrne, after spells in various newsrooms, as you said, you got what should have been a dream job at Granada TV. It was, however, a dream job with some downsides. You spoke about sexism and harassment in your McTaggart lecture. What sort of things were going on?
Well, some men of power regularly assaulted women, and everybody knew it and knew who they were. I don't mean that all the men were dreadful at all. You know, most were fantastic. But there was a level of sexism and sexual assault that was accepted. Subject matters for proper current affairs were regarded as being things like the CIA or nuclear power. And I think what a group of us as women across current affairs TV programmes at that time did was change the definition of what was regarded as a suitable subject for current affairs. Mm. When I was promoted to being a producer-director, I said that the first film I wanted to do was about rape and marriage, which was then not a crime. And one very senior person told me that that wasn't really a suitable subject for television current affairs. It was more suitable for morning TV, which would be a bit surprising, watching a programme about rape and marriage with your toddler. And one other man told me, that's not a story. Hmm. And now, subjects like domestic violence against men and women and subjects about women's everyday lives are accepted as being at the heart of what current affairs should be.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear next?
Well, I am one of those women who nearly forgot to have a baby, but luckily I remembered just in time, and I went to a clinic and I didn't think I would get pregnant because I was nearly 45, but I did. And it was like a miracle. You know, the day they told me I was pregnant, I lay on my bed and I laughed and laughed and laughed. And I thought, I'm going to have a little girl and she'll be called Hetty, and we'll be happy all our lives. And when my daughter was very small, I would tell her that story and she would say, and the amazing thing is, I am called Hetty. My mother didn't think it was so good at first. She even said to me, what will the neighbours think? And I said, funnily enough, when I decided to try and get pregnant, I wasn't thinking about your neighbours, but in fact, the queen neighbour, queen of the coffee set, when she met Hetty, said, well, if this had been available when I was young, I wouldn't have bothered with a husband. It was hard being a single parent and the editor of a TV programme. I had to go back to work 5.5 weeks and driving Hetty round on my own when she was very young with nobody else to entertain her. There was, for a long period, just one piece of music which would keep her quiet. I hated it, but it would definitely remind me of her.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels on the bus go round and round all day long. The horn on the bus goes beep, 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 beep.
Wheels on the Bus, performed by Leonard Piercy and Mary Thomas. Dorothy Byrne, alongside your career as a campaigning journalist, you've also been a health campaigner as someone who's experienced giant cell arteritis. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, I was diagnosed with two related autoimmune conditions, polymyalgia rheumatica and giant cell arteritis, with giant cell arteritis, if it's not diagnosed and treated in time, you can lose some or all of your sight. And every year, because doctors don't diagnose it quickly enough and then don't refer people to hospital quickly enough, hundreds of people lose some of their sight. This is absolutely preventable, and it's also irreversible. It affects women 3 times more than it affects men. And what we need as people with GCA is a fast track for treatment.
So you're looking for something similar to what has been done with strokes quite recently?
Yes. Some hospitals and health areas have achieved this, and they could all do it. I have interviewed women who have gone completely blind because they lost their sight because the doctors didn't diagnose and treat them in time.
And what are the symptoms, Dorothy?
You often get very tender scalp and terrible pain that you might mistake for being terrible earache or terrible toothache. And then your jaw may stop moving. And this is because the giant cells in your artery are inflamed, and that inflammation is moving up your head and is potentially going to press onto your eye, and you will lose your sight. And you need absolutely urgent treatment, and a high dose of steroids given immediately will save your sight. And my sight was saved.
It's time for your final disc. What's it going to be?
Well, the first time I heard this piece of music, I cried in a concert hall, and you're not even meant to breathe in a British concert hall, so that was quite embarrassing. It's the People United Will Never Be Defeated by Zhevsky, and it was dedicated to the people of Chile who had fought Pinochet. Why it is so moving is that at the beginning you can hear that the people are walking forward in glory, and then the music tells you that everything goes wrong and you feel that everything is destroyed. But then at the end, the theme begins again and you realise that the people united will never be defeated, and that's what makes you cry.
People United Will Never Be Defeated by Frederick Zhevsky, played by Igor Levitt. So, Dorothy Byrne, I'm about to maroon you on your desert island. How do you picture the place?
Well, I'm a bit worried about it because of the rising oceans, so I'm slightly concerned that I may just end up hanging on to a palm tree, but let's hope not.
You'll be given the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to keep you company. Which other book would you like?
I would like some physics textbooks because I never really studied physics at school. And I think if you're going to be on a desert island, it would be a good use of your time to find out all the secrets of the universe.
What about a luxury item?
My luxury is the voice of Melvyn Bragg. If I can't sleep, I find that if I put on Melvyn Bragg, particularly talking about papal infallibility, His voice has got a certain sound to it, and then I float away.
Well, we're not really supposed to give you communication devices or anything like that, so I can't give you a radio as such, but as we have provided people with, for example, the back catalogue of The Archers in the past, I can give you the back catalogue of In Our Time, which I have to say is hugely popular, one of the most downloaded programmes. Millions of listeners can't be wrong. It's yours. Enjoy. And finally, Dorothy, if the tide threatened to wash away your 8 discs, which would you dive in to save, do you think?
I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, because that is the piece of music that would give me hope that at some point, perhaps that little Greta sailing to some climate change conference would come by and rescue me.
Oh, I would love to see that. Dorothy Byrne, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you. It's just been such fun.
Hello, I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Dorothy Byrne. There are some fascinating journalists in our archive, including Alex Crawford, John Pilger and Kate Eady. I enjoyed meeting veteran journalist Hella Pick at the end of 2018. She told me about her amazing career, reporting on some of the most pivotal moments in world history. Pablo Casals, The Song of the Birds, with Pablo Casals on cello and Mieczysław Choszowski on piano, recorded live at the White House on November the 13th, 1961, with Kennedy in the audience, Hella Pick, who you met.
Well, meeting is a sort of slight exaggeration. I'd got to know quite well Pierre Salinger, who was Kennedy's spokesman, and he invited me to join them all in Hyannisport, their holiday home, for a party. And Pierre took me up to Kennedy, and somehow I managed to stumble and fall straight into his arms. But it was a very brief encounter.
While in the US, you reported on the 1965 Selma March, led, of course, by Martin Luther King to Montgomery, Alabama. Tell me about that experience.
Well, in many ways, unforgettable. It was such an event, that march. And, you know, in retrospect, I realised that I could very well have been murdered on that day, because I was lucky enough to be able to rent a car, and I had walked part of the way but always went back to the car. And at the end of the first day's march, I was talking to one of my colleagues from the Washington Post, and he was black. And I said, let me give you a ride back, which we did. And, of course, that was, you know, an invitation to be shot, because at that time, you know, people were shot, because a white woman, black man in a car sitting together was simply not done. But we got back. But when we got back to the hotel, when we went to the bar, they asked him to leave. And I covered quite a lot of the other civil rights events during that period, and, you know, it was nasty. And, I mean, the whole march at the end, you know, you knew something had changed. You know, life was never going to be quite the same again.
Hella Pick speaking to me back in November 2018. Her programme is available to download now via BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be the author and illustrator, Chris Riddell. I do hope you'll join us.
Hi everyone, Russell Cain here. I've got just a few seconds to tell you about Evil Genius, our hit podcast, 2.5 million downloads in 2019, top 10, where we take people from history, Gandhi, Margaret Thatcher, John Lennon, and detonate fact bombs around their reputations. It's stuff you don't want to know, but you really do want to know. At the end of a lively debate, my panel of esteemed guests, read banging comedians, all have to vote evil or genius. There's no grey area. This is cancel culture turned into an innovative format. Subscribe to Evil Genius on BBC Sounds now.